Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. On December 6, 1917, Finland declared itself an independent republic, breaking with Russia. On this important 100th celebration, I visited Helsinki at the invitation of the Finnish Literature Exchange, FILI, to explore some of the wonderful stories coming out of the country from a new generation of Finns. On previous episodes of Meet the Writers, you will have heard from representatives of FILI and also from a Finnish publisher and from probably the best-known Finnish author, Sofi Oksanen. Today, I meet a man who ensures that the superb writing originating in Finland is accessible to an English-speaking readership. And we also meet one of the brightest, fresh, young voices documenting the migrant experience. I'm in the Kallio Library in Helsinki, just sitting down with translator David Haxton.
David, you translate from Finnish to English. How did you, as an Englishman, come to speak Finnish to the degree where you're able to translate extremely literary works?
I started studying Finnish in 1996 when I was an exchange student here in Finland. So Finnish was somehow wild and exotic and doesn't look like anything you've ever seen before, so it was kind of fascinating to someone who's interested in languages. And then when I went back to London, continued studying for a little while, and then once you graduate, of course, then you think, well, I've got this degree now, what am I going to do with this degree? Oh, I could translate literature. I like reading and I like working with language, and I started working at FILI. Actually, I worked as an intern in 2001. Finnish Literary Exchange, I believe it is officially in English. So they have an intern every 6 months, it changes, and I was the intern in 2001. So you work with them, and of course, through doing that, then you learn about the way the publishing business works in Finland, and you make a lot of contacts with people, and you meet authors, and then you start off with small translations, and then people read them, and then gradually you build up a portfolio and a reputation.
Translating is not just being able to put something from one language into another, though, is it? It's a very creative process. In a way, you are the writer themselves.
Absolutely. And some authors, I think, they have control issues often when they realise quite how much things have to change when you move. It's not just about one language to another, it's one culture to another, one context to another, and so things do have to change. A translator is very creative, has to be, otherwise you could just get a computer to do it.
So how does that work? Do you have to have a close relationship with the writer? Do you have to understand how their brain works in order to make their words make sense in a different language, or can they just do it remotely? Here's my text, do with it as you wish.
Well, we don't do quite what we wish. Obviously, you stick to the words that are written, but I don't think you need to know the author. You need to know about the author, certainly, and have an appreciation of what they are trying to achieve with the novel and the context in which they've written the novel, and then think about how you can transfer that into a context that's understandable to a reader in another language. So in this case, an English-speaking readership, how will they appreciate things like, for instance, the way that the Second World War played out in Finland was really rather different from the way it played out in the UK. And there were different political forces at work, and it really was a very different story, a very individual story. So if you're translating a book that's set during the war in Finland, then that's a cultural consideration that you have to be aware that certain things that are really obvious to Finnish readers are not necessarily so obvious to English-speaking readers. And of course, this is something that takes us beyond the words on the page. You could translate the words, but they might not mean anything. So somehow, when you're choosing the words that you put on the page, then perhaps you have to be aware that you're introducing an entirely new history to a reader.
What about things like humour and metaphor?
Humour is very hard to translate, I think, because different people laugh at different things. So what a British audience finds funny is not necessarily what an American audience finds funny, for instance, and we all speak the same language, apparently. So again, Finland has a long history of humour and comedy, both in literature and the theatre, TV. if you tell a joke and nobody laughs and you have to explain why it's funny, then it's not funny anymore. So, and it's the same in translation, I think. If you have to sort of, if it's going to involve too much sort of acrobatics, I think, to make it funny, then no one's going to laugh, and then you've sort of lost the audience in a way. So it is tricky, and it's always, each instance is always different. So you come up with a strategy of how am I going to overcome this particular situation in which it's important that the reader laughs, or it's very difficult.
Yeah. And what about metaphor?
I think a lot of metaphors, I don't think necessarily they're things that other cultures and other readers can't understand. Although, for instance, if we think of English, there's a certain way that writers talk about, let's say, the countryside, okay, and the sort of associated metaphors they use with the countryside. And of course, in Finland, the countryside, A, looks different, and there's, B, different plants and trees and animals. So there's a different sort of vocabulary or associated with the countryside, and therefore the metaphors are different. So then when you translate something, then you're stuck with this question of, should I use a more familiar metaphor or simile, or should I use the author's one? I generally use the author's one, although then you'll always get somebody who says, oh, that was a bit funny, what a funny translation. But then actually it's not about the translation, it's about people see it in a different way, and so their metaphor is different. So that's an instance in which I would really tend to stick fairly closely to the words that the author's chosen, because they chose them for a reason, so there's no reason for me to change them.
Language do you think in?
English. Yeah, it's my native language, and I've spoken it since I was a child. So I count in English all the time. And of course, I can count in Finnish. Sometimes I think in Finnish if it's a context in which I always do something in Finnish. But then counting is a weird one. It's so ingrained, I think, that it's just very difficult to get your head around. You have to quickly count something up. And just always resort to English. It's always easier.
Finally, translators, I feel, often don't get the credit that they're due. Do you think that that's something that's felt generally within the translation industry, that actually you're doing all this work and that it's tremendously important? And I'm thinking here particularly of Orhan Pamuk, who changed his translator. And I found that his work was very, very different when not translated, for instance, by Maureen Freely.
I'm not so well acquainted with the Pamuk case, but it's absolutely true. If you have a different translator, there's a different style. Well, let's row back on that. I mean, the author's style will remain, but there's a different way of looking at that style, and each translator brings their own experience and their own use of language with them. So, for instance, American translators and British translators, we translate in really different ways, but we can both be, in inverted commas, faithful to an author while still having our own voice. Or this idea of a translator's voice is of course problematic, because then it's that you're introducing something into the novel of your own that isn't necessarily there, and yet of course we're introducing something to the novel. Unfortunately, there are some authors who sort of sit down and say, oh, but why have you changed this word? And my stock answer is always, well, if you look very carefully, I've changed them all, because they're in a different language. So the thing about translators getting credit is a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, of course, we sit for hours and hours and hours at our computers by ourselves engaging with this book, and then we produce a vision of the book that we think is genuine and representative of the book. And then if a review doesn't mention the translator, then you do think, oh, yet again, I'm not mentioned. But on the other hand, I mean, recently, it's the first time any of my translations has ever been reviewed in the New York Times and the New Yorker, and I was thrilled, and neither of them mentioned my name. But in a way, I didn't mind. Some translators would really, really object to this, and I understand why. But on the other hand, I'm happy that the New York Times and the New Yorker were engaging with this novel as a novel and not as a translated novel. And so in a way, then I have really done my job. If the fact that it's a translation is not impeding somebody from looking at it as a work of art in its own right, not a translated work of art, as if being translated is somehow a sort of minus point. But, I mean, obviously, credit where credit's due, of course, and ideally, yes, translators should always be credited in publicity and in reviews and things, but there's a, I mean, we often talk about the invisibility of the translator. So I mean, if you make yourself so invisible that the author's own voice shines through in the new language, that's also a positive.
That's David Haxton. One of the books David's translated is My Cat Yugoslavia. It's by Python Statoksi. I went to the Arcadia International Bookshop in Helsinki to have a chat with Python.
Python, tell me about your life, because you were not born here in Finland.
I was born in Kosovo in 1990, which was part of the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And my family fled there in 92, and then we moved to Finland. So I grew up in Finland and attended Finnish schools. So I was so young that I don't have any memories of life before Finland. But I guess this is one of the main reasons I am attracted to the area and the history of the Balkans, because it's a big part of my heritage and my life.
How was it growing up? Because presumably for your parents, it must have been much harder. They came here as adults. They were trying to fit into a completely alien culture.
The first generation has to struggle a bit more than the second generation in terms of especially language, because I don't have any memories of ever having to learn Finnish. It just came automatically because I was so young. I don't have any experience of any other kind of environment than the one that I have. So, you know, when people keep talking about growing up between two worlds or two different cultures, I partly have to disagree on that, because it never felt like two different worlds. It felt one world to me, and it was whole and beautiful as it was. And of course, there were questions about how should I define myself in relation to my mother language or in the culture I was raised in or whatnot. But I think that these questions are present in everyone's life, not only in the lives of people who have migrated from one place to another.
Insofar as the migrant experience goes, and as you say, that was your normality, so you had nothing to compare it to, but I wonder if you felt sidelined from mainstream Finnish culture at all and felt any kind of resistance from people who had been here from generations.
Well, I was always accepted in every environment I was. I was accepted in school and everywhere else, but of course you will meet people who think of you a certain way just because you are from somewhere else originally. Sometimes it was difficult for me to put that aside and say that it's just one person who dislikes me because of how I look or how I speak or where I come from. But I think I have lived a pretty normal life.
I have been so pleased to find this book, My Cat Yugoslavia, and I'm not sure that I would have come across it had it not been for this visit to Helsinki. Although actually, it's been incredibly well reviewed. You've got a lot of attention in America. I know that the New York Times ran a piece about it. Just tell me about your journey to this point in terms of writing.
It feels like a dream, basically, because I started writing this book in 2010. And back then I was working at a supermarket as a cashier while simultaneously studying comparative literature at the university. And I've always known that I want to be a writer. I've consumed stories in every single form since I was really, really young. So one night I just got really frustrated with the job I was doing. And so I came home after a late shift and asked myself, what's stopping me from starting this book today, since I had an idea of a book that I would like to write myself one day. So I just sat down and began writing the first chapters. And then 18 months later, I had a manuscript in my hands. And then I sent it to three major publishers here in Finland. And here in Finland, we don't have literary agencies who first accept the manuscript and start looking for a publisher, but here you just send them to the publishers. And so when I got stuck with the story, I just sent it to these publishing companies and wrote a brief cover letter with my contact information. And it was 2 a.m. in the morning, I think. And then I sent it, and the second I did it, I was like, man, now I know what I have should done with the manuscript. But then I went to bed, and then I got a phone call from a publishing company here the next afternoon. I hadn't heard of anything like that happening ever before, so I was astounded by it. So then I met with them the day after, and then after I came out from the meeting with them, another publishing company called, and then I signed a contract that felt comfortable to me, and then started working on the novel. And never in a million years did I think that someday I would travel the world with this book. I was in the United States for a couple of months when the book came out in the US, and I was walking in Soho in New York a couple of weeks after the book had come out, and then I passed a bookstore called McNally Jackson in Soho, and I saw my book in the window, and I was like, what is happening to me? And it was like right next to the books of authors that I look up to and admire. Later in Brooklyn, in another bookstore, I saw it again, and I became one of those people who took pictures of their own books, because it was so unbelievable to me that it didn't even feel real. But now that I have had time to process it, I'm going to carry this memory for the rest of my life. It's great.
It's a fantastic book, and I would really love for you to tell us about it. It's called My Cat Yugoslavia. So let's talk about, first of all, why a talking cat?
Why not a talking cat? I mean, initially I was inspired by this theory called animal studies, which basically says that it's trying to locate how animals are, through anthropomorphization, othered, and their voices are stolen by humans who construct representations of animals in the arts that are always filtered in creation and in interpretation through the human world. So in this way, we take away the animal's right to represent themselves. So this theory intrigued me because it also states that animals are read and interpreted differently inside each culture. So there's a relation between animal others and, for example, ethnic and sexual others. And because I wanted to write about being oppressed because of your nationality or your sexuality, so this was the main idea of using these animal characters in them. So that's why I have all kinds of feline creatures in the book. Some of them talk, some of them don't talk. And just to highlight the fact that we are all unique, and even though we might have strong images and ideas and stereotypes of what cats are like, for example, it's a fact that we don't have access to an other's consciousness, and we don't know what is happening inside another person's or an animal's mind, but still oftentimes we do think so, and then we write about it, and then we oftentimes even have books that have animal narrators in them, and we give them a language system and a culture from inside our world to understand ourselves better, mm-hmm. even though the whole process is sort of an act of stealing something that we don't know what we are stealing, because, like I said, animals are, all of them have a unique presence and experience of being in the world.
And we relate to them differently wherever we are in the world. I wonder how cats are perceived in Kosovo, for instance.
It's an important section to me because Bekim, one of my protagonists, says somewhere in the book that it's a different thing to say that you're Swedish or German or French than to say that you are from Turkey or Iraq. It could have gone equally like this, that it's a different thing to tell people that you're a cat or a dog than to tell them that you're a cockroach or a snake, because we all live in a world of stereotypes and violence. And Bekim, for example, a protagonist, he goes out in the beginning of the book to buy a pet boa constrictor, a big strangle snake. What I meant to say with the whole thing that happens with the snake is that he buys it even though he's really oidophobic, like terrified of snakes. He buys it because he relates to its position in the world and how it is perceived as a dangerous or a violent animal. And people are scared of snakes. It's very common to be scared of snakes. And he relates to it because he projects his own senses of otherness through it, and he gets it because he relates to it in a mental way, because he feels like he's always been othered by his ethnic background, that he has come to learn ashamed because the media throughout his life keeps covering Kosovo as a restless area and always writing about Kosovo in a negative fashion. So that's why he also keeps lying about his past because of this, because he thinks that being an Albanian is something that's not to be proud of.
I'm perhaps giving the mistaken impression that this book is about animals. It's not really about animals. It's about, I suppose, the dislocation of losing a homeland, an identity, a childhood, and the legacy of loss across generations. Also about sexuality. How would you sum up the book?
This is a very difficult question, and people keep asking about this, so I probably should have learned an answer by now. But I think it's a book about sadness and loneliness and dislocation in a way, because how I think of it, it doesn't have necessarily a happy ending. I didn't want it to have a happy ending, but then my publisher, until the end, they kept saying that it should have some kind of like a beak of hope somewhere in the end. And I wanted to write about people who confront really big problems and issues and battles in their lives and not necessarily win them, because we keep reading about stories of how our struggles and difficulties make us stronger in the end, and they give us strength and fortitude. But to these people, it doesn't, because there are a lot of people who never win, who just have to adapt in the situation they are given. And
that's so interesting, challenging that narrative that just fortitude and good hard work and strength will carry you through. Sometimes it just doesn't.
Yeah, sometimes it doesn't. It really doesn't. So it was like a conscious thing for me to do, and I wanted to write a sad book. But then there is hope in sadness, in a way, too.
There is a passage in here that I felt that everybody who has ever resented an immigrant or not really thought about their reaction to somebody other should read. And it's this. It's imagine having to abandon your family, having to witness your loved ones die in an explosion, or imagine being so desperate that you turn to God, though you don't believe in him. And then you carry on. You say, tell me, what would you do if you were forced to move to a country that despises your faith and you'd never be able to go home again? If you had to learn a foreign language, taught in a foreign language, how quickly do you think you'd be able to land a customer services job? And I just think that that is something. Those are questions we don't ask ourselves generally when we look at somebody who's come to our country, who speaks a different language, who is perhaps languishing in a job that they don't particularly want to do. How hard must that be?
Yeah, exactly. And we should think about these questions. We don't know anything about other people's struggles. And still, we have highly opinionated people in the public sphere who talk about these things about immigration and without having any experience of what it is like to be an immigrant or what it is like to move from one country to another. I don't have the experience per se because I was so young when I moved here. So for me, it was a bit easier because I never felt like I left anything behind because of my lack of memories, because I was so young. So the world that I know now, that I was raised in, is the only world I know. But for my parents, for example, it was, they left their history behind and moved here. And I just wanted to tap that experience. And I thank my parents in the end, in the acknowledgements, because of they were so open when telling me about what it was actually like. And now, as an adult and a writer of fiction, it motivates me to explore these questions even more, because when I write, I transform to the person I am writing about. So I imagine a whole world around myself. And when I was writing this book, I did just that. I imagined that I was this person, this Emine, the other narrator who's telling her story. Then I came across really like big questions, and it's sad.
What are you working on next? Is this a theme you think that will go through your work, the immigrant experience, the gay experience?
When magazines are writing about my work, they are referring me to as this immigrant writer, or I am writing through the eyes of an outsider, and I don't feel like I am an immigrant or an outsider, and this kind of speech closes me out of Finland. And the culture I'm inside because I am here and that's it. I think that these themes, who am I, what am I doing here, that's what I'm basically writing about in this book. These people are, of course, immigrants, but these themes about sexuality and ethnicity in the world that is globalizing more and more every day are universal questions. The question about immigration and immigrants doesn't only refer to immigrants. It refers to every single person in this whole wide world.
So what's next?
I am writing a third book. It's funny to me to be talking about this book because I finished it in the beginning of 2014 and it came out in Finnish later that year. It just came out in English a couple of months ago. So it's been almost over 3 years that I finished it. And I've written a second novel after that, which is coming out in English. I think they decided on next year, late next year. So I'm writing a third one. Let's see, it's still a bit chaotic. I don't know what's happening there.
Well, I think yours is a name that we should watch. Anything that you write is absolutely, I think, going to fly off the shelves. Thank you.
Payton Statoski's book, My Cat Yugoslavia, is published in English by Pushkin Press, and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. My thanks to the Finnish Literature Exchange, to George McDonough, and of course to my guests. You can always download this programme or previous episodes to listen to at your leisure from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or from our own Monocle.com website. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.